play. They couldn't take a direct route as ports dotted the path leading to the target. Pandora had identified some as exhausts for gases that would damage their suits, and they agreed that avoiding both those and the ones whose purpose was unknown was the logical choice.
Faster,
Saint growled, and the team increased from a fast walk to a slow lope. They'd all drawn their weapons, so when enemy troops appeared a score of meters away, crawling like spiders out of an opening in the hull, they fired without waiting. Bullets flew across the space between them, and grenades followed. Laser beams lanced across the gap, while the physical munitions traveled. Battle armor protected the aliens, shedding the energy that had been reduced in power as it crossed to them. The projectiles arrived and impacted the enemy suits, accompanied by shrapnel from fragmentation grenades and the concussion of incendiaries that mostly failed in the airless environment. The enemies continued, undeterred, moving in lockstep and holding their own fire as they neared.
Not good, Sinner said. Faster, people.
They increased their speed again, now risking the security of their footholds as they leapt in short bounds along the fortress's surface. The tethers were their fallback, but the trade-off was that a hard enough strike had the potential to pull all of them off the hull, which would be far less than optimal.
Let's try sticking them,
Sinner ordered, and the Marines who had the rifles with attached grenade launchers loaded and fired web grenades. Upon impact, they ejected sticky strands in every direction, coating the first rank of the aliens and securing them to the base. The non-Newtonian characteristics of the webs resulted in increased resistance as the enemy pushed against them, hardening and locking them into place. A second rank of enemies moved around the front line and continued to advance, followed by the other two sets of four. The webbed soldiers fired into the sticky threads that connected them to the base. Projectiles were ineffective, but energy blasts began to find success in parting the strands.
Damn it, Paris observed.
These guys suck,
Sinner agreed. Then the enemy was in range, and the two forces traded shots in earnest. The running Marines took worse than they gave because they were on a predictable path, and the aliens were far more stable in their steady march. Saint's display showed him the suit conditions of each of his people as they degraded from dark green to light green and into pure yellow.
Stop and counter, he ordered.
The Marines twisted and crouched on their next landing, bringing weapons to their shoulders. They operated in pairs. Their suits automatically supplied targeting information from the first member to the second. Coordinated fire stabbed out at the aliens, targeting knee joints wherever headshots were impossible. Several stumbled backward under the onslaught, but the suit's computers registered no kills. They continued the barrage as the enemy dropped to their chests to return fire, and again Saint watched his people's suit integrity fall.
Easy, Paris and Char, you're with me. Surfer, swap weapons with Paris. We'll need the launcher. We'll smother these bastards in grenades while you all advance.
Saint,
Sinner began over their private channel, and he barked,
Stow it, Sin. You know what's at stake.
I'm going to kick your ass for sending me ahead, Saint. Count on it, she said.
Then he heard her over the general channel, calling,
Move it, people!
He hunkered down with his team and created a channel just for them.
Here's what we are going to do. Smoke grenades in front of them. Web grenades in the middle of them. Easy. Pull out your big gun and go for headshots. Paris and Char, get in front and protect her.
Saint ran cables from his backpack and easies up to the other two.
Use your shields when you need to. They'll draw power from our suits as well. When you hit orange, lay down smoke again, and all of you, run. I'll be rear guard.
His Marines knew better than to argue, and they took position under the cover of the first round of smoke.
I can give you an assist, Gee-Whiz said. We finally broken through and have a foothold in their security system.
Ghostly outlines appeared in their helmets as the sub-Pandoras drew the locations of the enemy troops on their displays.
We're getting telemetry from their suits, so assuming Pandora is doing her job right, these should be perfectly accurate.
You are my new favorite person, Gee-Whiz.
Easy breathed, her voice slow as it always was when she was in sniper mode.
This is the best present ever.
Saint saw the gases escape as the custom bullet, part of a set she always carried, designed specifically to work in the absence of atmosphere, flew from the barrel. In the heads-up display, he watched it impact against the helmet of an enemy soldier. The tip was sharp and made of the densest material they had, and was backed by a thin needle of the same substance. As the round deformed from impact, the needle continued forward, piercing the armor without blunting and driving into the skull inside it. The suit fell to the ground and lay motionless. Incoming fire battered the two in front of the sniper as they blocked the rounds that sought her. The only vulnerability was the barrel of the rifle, where it peaked between their armored forms. Another round flew to claim another kill. Easy was able to mow down half the enemy force before the aliens reduced the blocker's safety to bloody orange. Saint leapt in front, and Easy took a final shot between his parted legs, killing one last bird.
"Smoke, then run," he ordered.
Canisters flew past him, and he saw their icons leave him behind as they obeyed. The green forms marking the enemy soldiers marched forward, and he assessed their position against the curtain of smoke and noise that separated them. He took a deep breath and raised his rifle, then fired a barrage of energy at the hazy outlines. The goal wasn't to eliminate them, although he'd take any luck he could get, but to delay them for a few more precious seconds as his troops moved away. An instant later, their return fire found his armor and knocked him backward a step. Saint stowed the weapon on his back and leapt in a dive toward Sinner's force in the distance, activating his suit jets and taking flight along the surface of the installation. Enemy rounds battered him as he climbed at an angle, trying to steer with leg motions that weren't working properly, with no atmosphere to push against. He started to spin, then fired his grapnel toward the metal hull below. Its momentum failed to carry it far enough, and he trailed further and further away from the fortress as he flew. He growled in frustration, then heard Sinner's voice in his ears. She said,
"Saint, you're an idiot!"
He felt the impact of a grapnel as it hit the chest of his suit. He followed the line to find Sinner at the other end, attached by a tether to Surfer, who also hung in space, connected by his own cords to Alvi below. Each Marine activated their winch, and they were pulled back to the base. They were all so distracted by the rescue attempt that none of them saw the approaching danger until it was upon them. An enemy fighter blasted into view and strafed the station with energy as it passed. It was followed by a human fighter whose errant bolts also splashed onto the skin of the fortress. There was no time to react, no time to respond. When the incandescence had cleared, and the spots dissolved from his eyes, Saint looked in horror at his display. Only 5 Marines were still alive, and one of those read as unconscious, her suit administering drugs and tourniquets to stop the blood flow from shattered bones on all her extremities. As he watched, Easy's vital signs slipped into a state that indicated a medical coma.
"God's damned bastards!"
Sinner choked in fury and anguish. Saint's shocked senses registered the oncoming green hazes in the distance, and he forced himself into motion.
"Grieve later. We still have a job to do. Surfer, Flame, tether Easy. Sin, grab Flame's plasma cord. Then run, top speed. Hit the amps."
The Marine's power armor had a supply of last resort options. One of them was a cocktail of amphetamines and painkillers that would keep them going far beyond the limits where their brains would normally shut down. He triggered the injection and felt the energy burn through his veins as the drugs flowed through him. He ran full out for their target, just tens of meters away now. When he arrived, he loaded every explosive he had into a pile on the mark. Sinner slid into place moments later and slapped the plasma cord down in a ring, attaching a small detonator. By the time the other 3 joined them, they were ready.
"Blow it," Saint said,
and the incendiary burned another hole into the fortress's skin. He triggered the explosives, which sent the freed disc careening down into the space below. He leapt in after it with a battle cry and fired his grapnel to pull himself in. On the way down, he drew his pistol and extended his arm to fire 6 shots in rapid succession at the suited figures below, killing or drastically wounding each alien he targeted. The birds, without pressure suits, succumbed quickly to the airless environment, the sound of bulkheads crashing down to keep air from evacuating from nearby compartments filled the space. Sinner followed, taking out the remaining opposition. Saint clamped his boots magnetically to the floor and marched to an intact computer interface along one wall, muttering curses under his breath with each step. He reached behind his back and triggered the release of a large object from his backpack. He placed the largest version of the Pandora disc down on the terminal and watched it come alive as it attacked the enemy system. With his job done, he collapsed to the ground. Saint managed to speak despite the sand that coated his tongue.
"Trap the doors and lock us in. We can only hope we got here soon enough. And be ready to shoot any idiots that tried to get in from outside."
His muscles failed him as he tried to rise to guard the hole, and he fell into blissful unconsciousness.
Chapter 36. The atmosphere in the Planetary Defense Center was charged with tension. Emperor Krata-Tok stood, regarding the holodisplay in the same location he'd inhabited since the first report of the humans' incursion into their space. On his right, and a step behind, was the dark form of Varen. Subtle menace radiated from her, so palpable even he could feel it, despite it not being directed at him. On his other side, his seneschal, Chani, busied himself taking reports and passing the essential details on to him. He focused beyond the projection and scanned each of the faces of his senior officers in turn. Each looked appropriately concerned. Several, though, carried a touch of hopelessness, maybe even reverence in their expressions. Krata himself was filled with calm assurance that the battle would resolve as the gods wished it to, with their decisive victory over the humans. As the asteroid trap deployed, the room broke into cheers at the wide swath of destruction caused by first the shrapnel and then the boulders that latched onto the human ships. He frowned at the antics of one of the Domeki vessels and gestured at Chani, who immediately moved to confer with the officer acting as liaison with the Ruby Rain. That ship needed to be removed from the board as soon as possible. Krata growled in anger as the human's desperate repositioning put them out of reach of his forces. Indrat did her job, and her orders flowed to redeploy in pursuit. He embraced this moment of lull in the battle as an opportunity to sit and refresh himself with whiskey-laced tisane and a plate of sweets. As he nibbled, he watched the pieces reposition and rocket toward one another to resume the fight. He launched out of his chair at the sight of a Zhroshan carrier sending its fighters against his ships.
"Why hasn't that captured carrier been destroyed yet?" he demanded.
Several of his officers paled under the stinging bite of his tone.
"We have judged it as a priority, second to that of destroying the Domeki vessel, Emperor," replied High Commander Malus Fatal.
Krata grunted, but didn't pressure the issue.
His attention was caught by additional icons appearing on the screen, beyond the alien's initial ingress point, which then flooded through the gap.
"What are those?" he asked.
After several moments of conferral, Malus answered,
"They're identified as missile boats, Emperor."
The ships confirmed that designation with the coordinated launch of hundreds of torpedoes aimed at one of the fortresses. He frowned and considered this development. Deep within him, a feeling kindled. It bore the warm touch of Leilana and the frigid ice of Vasoi. He sent his thoughts spiraling inward to embrace the gift of wisdom the gods were sending. His eyes closed and his wings shifted slightly to maintain his balance as his mind descended. He saw Vasoi, the destroyer, and his patron goddess seated on a pair of thrones that bore a striking resemblance to the one at the palace. Vasoi, in the larger of the two seats, nodded at him.
"The time has come, Krata-Tok. We've sown the seeds of this enemy's destruction, and the time is nigh to reap what has grown."
From the smaller chair at her right hand, Leilana gifted him with a smile.
You have done all that can be done, Emperor, save this single thing. It is time to wipe the humans from the board in a single stroke, time to conclude this war and deliver victory to the Zhoshin people.
He opened his mouth to speak, to protest that conventional approaches would win the day, but felt an icy stab in his chest. Basoy was frowning, and Leilana hastened to intercede, with a frown marring her beautiful features as well.
You are our chosen, Crotta. Do our will, and do it now!
The vision left him, and he stumbled into Varen's waiting arms. His protector studied him, supporting his weight until he was prepared to stand on his own again. He straightened, unfurled his wings, and spread his hands.
It's time! He crowed.
The surety of the gods running through his veins. His outburst startled his commanders, and Malice gestured at the display, as if to say,
We have this under control.
Crotta nodded at her with sympathy and understanding in his gaze. Nonetheless, he insisted.
It is time, High Commander. Prepare the field.
The woman turned to her subordinates and began to issue orders. The activity level among the technicians ratcheted up, then increased again as the word spread. Soon every person in the room save Crotta and his pair of lieutenants was speaking quickly into headsets and punching commands into displays. On the holographic representation of the system, ships began to move. The fortresses developed a glow along various surfaces, resembling an unending line that traveled the sphere in a series of right angles and short straightaways. The giant installations overcame inertia and shifted, one moving away from the planet and toward the rear of the fighting lines, the other repositioning toward the human's entry point. Countdown clocks appeared and hovered over each, to indicate time remaining until it reached position. The larger number was below 2 minutes. Crotta gave an approving nod to Malice, who met his eyes briefly before finding an excuse to look elsewhere.
No matter, he thought. Once victory is ours, the uncomfortable measures we were forced to take to ensure it will be lost to history.
Several more stealth ships, outfitted as sacrifices and operated by remote, emerged from their blackout shrouds. They shot toward preset spots throughout the system to create a symmetrical grid inside it. Finally, a number of rammers, also destined for sacrifice, moved into locations chosen by the technicians to accommodate unexpected deployments by the enemy. The entire exercise was a mammoth calculation of force, gravity, and destructive potential in 3 dimensions, exacerbated by the constantly changing positions of the pieces. The countdown clocks all ticked to 0, and finally his ships were in place.
For those who haven't been fully briefed, Crotta said, allow me to explain. The gods have gifted me with a final strategy for this battle, a way to ensure our victory. The costs are high, but must be borne in the name of service to those deities, and service to the future of the Zhoshin people. This day will mark a new beginning as we destroy the human fleet and remove the greatest impediment blocking our ancestors from their transition into paradise.
He was ready to give the order, but the expert performer within him that had been so pivotal to his rise to hierarch and then emperor knew the impact would be much greater if he added one more element.
High Commander Malice, please show us on that screen what will happen.
He waved at an enormous display set into the wall. Her surprise at the request showed for an instant, then she forced her expression to neutral.
Yes, Emperor, she said, and snapped her fingers at a nearby technician.
The screen lit up with a mountaintop view of the battlefield. The fortresses began to glow, then detonated, and hurled shrapnel in all directions. The display illustrated the shockwave that traveled before the debris as a light orange line. As it reached each of the ships in the grid, it triggered their sacrifice, which increased and reinforced the destructive potential flying through the system. By the time the wave intersected with non-sacrifice ships, the energy was so overwhelming they couldn't hope to defend themselves against it. They fell in sequence as the wave reached them. When the line met the asteroid field, the inner layer of rocks was reduced to shrapnel that rebounded into the system.
After several minutes, the waves diminished to reveal a minimal number of vessels in the sector, those who were protected by perfect positioning or random fortune. Blasts stabbed out from the planet to eliminate the enemies that remained. There was a collective gasp from those who hadn't been informed of this final option. Crotta nodded. Now it was indeed time.
"Execute," he said.
And despite the clear misgivings on her face, Malice did her duty, personally entering the command to trigger the cascade. They all turned to the holodisplay, some in anticipation, he knew, and others, no doubt, like his soft-hearted seneschal, in dread of what was to come. The joy of the moment filled him, sending little jolts of pleasure along his nerves as he awaited his ultimate victory. Seconds passed, and nothing happened. Deep uncertainty seeped into his belly to replace the confidence the gods had bestowed, and he speared Malice with a glare. She was already in motion to a nearby terminal, and her voice was filled with pain as she reported the results.
"The fortresses are not responding, Emperor."
"What?"
he screamed, advancing toward her. There was a rasp of metal as Varin drew her blades and moved in step with him, ready to protect him or execute his will.
"Emperor," she stammered, "we're attempting to connect now."
Moments later, the conversation between a technician and the commander of one of the fortresses was routed to the speakers set in the high ceiling of the room.
"Repeat, we are under attack by a human force. They've taken over auxiliary control and have locked us from our systems. Our technicians are doing their best, but at this time we don't have access to the controls of the Jade Sky."
Crotta barked.
"Why did we not know this? What of the other one?"
The High Commander refused to meet his gaze, but kept her head down while her hands flew across the control panel.
"Jamming, Emperor, at a power level and complexity we've never seen. It is clearly Domeki technology."
Sapphire washed over his eyes as his blood pressure rose, and he growled deep in his throat.
"Can we accomplish the cascade without the fortress?"
he forced out through his locked jaw. His hands itched for violence. He noted in a tiny part of his mind that his seneschal stood blocking the most direct line between Malice and Varin. It made him want Chani dead as well.
"No, Emperor. At best, we'll take out a small portion of the human forces. Without the energy of the fortresses, the plan is ineffective."
He screamed, turning his head to the ceiling and spreading his arms wide. It lasted until his throat was on fire, then left him drained and, for an instant, defeated. That was when the icon caught his eye. The designation above it read, Washington, D.C. It shimmered in yellow, marked by one of the technicians for his attention.
"The trespassers!" he roared. "Use the planetary cannon! Destroy that ship!"
Chapter 37
"Walsh! Kill it!"
Cross yelled as the enemy cruiser cut in front of them. The Washington was down to her starboard broadside, most of which was still functional, and her forward tubes. The loss of an engine had reduced both speed and defensive power for the shields, and so they skirted the edges of the main melee and headed for the cluster of ships that were closing on the Pandora. The tunnel jump had positioned them near the end of the semicircle, across the zone from Kate, and the Washington and what remained of her squadron, the Tianjin, Saskatoon, and Kilkenny, were pushing their engines beyond the red line to reach her in time to make a difference. The distance was short relative to the size of the system, but there were a lot of enemies to avoid along the way. Her lost engine left her trailing, which gave her opportunities to finish off ships that her squadron had already damaged. Beams and missiles erupted from the starboard side of the ship, and more torpedoes launched from the forward tubes to curve around toward the aliens. Cross watched with satisfaction as they knocked the enemy vessel into a spin and sent it flipping into a nearby asteroid to explode.
"All right. It looks like there's a set of triangle ships turning to block us," he said over the squadron channel. "Tianjin, your job is to throw missiles and energy at all of them. Saskatoon, you follow that up with a strike at the one in the upper left as we go by. Kilkenny, you've got the one that's closest. I'll take the one in the upper right."
Cross leaned forward in anticipation of giving the next command to kill an enemy ship, watching his chosen target grow on the main screen. When the Washington bucked like the fist of a god had delivered an uppercut to her bow. The bridge plunged into darkness and then climbed to minimal illumination provided by the already diminished battery backup. He focused his eyes past a vibration in his vision that he blamed on the ringing in his head
until he realized the ship was really shaking.
Walsh and Lee hung unconscious against their restraints, and Cross's body took that as inspiration to inform him that his own safety webbing had dug into his skin violently enough to cause instant bruising. The internal gravity fluctuated, making him nauseous as he hit the automatic release for his belts. When the button failed to respond, he growled and grabbed the all-purpose tool set into the underside of every chair on the ship and used it to saw through the straps. A look at the main screen told him his ship was dying and he wouldn't be able to save her. He closed his eyes against the sudden pain in his stomach, but ended the moment of indulgence almost immediately.
Jacobs, oversee the evacuation. Flores and Fitzpatrick, stabilize the wounded and take them to escape pods, he barked.
His officers moved as Cross finished cutting his way out of his safety web. He met Fitzpatrick at the helm and helped her secure an immobilizing collar around Lee's neck. Together, they undid his belt and lowered him gently to the deck. Across the bridge, Flores had broken a capsule of smelling salts open to awaken Walsh and assisted the older man from his chair. The acrid odor carried to Cross and added to his sensory misery as he slid into Lee's seat and let muscle memory guide his hands. His ambulatory officers retrieved a portable litter, essentially a reinforced canvas blanket with handholds, from the ready room and loaded Lee onto it. They vanished from his attention, and he finished entering his override commands. He triggered the evacuation alarm. The computerized voice was a shriek on his battered nerves as it dispassionately announced,
"Evacuate ship. All personnel to escape pods. This is not a drill. Evacuate ship."
The instructions would play in a continuous loop until their rescuers turned it off or the Washington came apart.
"Status, Matthews!"
he shouted over the din as he glanced at the main display, which was increasing in intensity to the point that soon it might even be useful. He shook his head in frustration. His hands completed the process of setting up the helm station into his preferred arrangement. A side panel on the chair unfolded, and a reinforced arm rose with a fighter control stick mounted to the top. This configuration was rarely used on non-atmospheric ships, but he figured he needed every option available and every edge he could get to give his crew time to abandon the Washington before an alien noticed them drifting and blasted them from the universe.
"The planet shot us," Matthews said in disgust. "The shields had no chance of stopping it."
Cross shook his head, then immediately regretted it as another wave of nausea swept through him. The main screen had reached a level where looking at it left him disoriented by the tumbling of the ship. He locked his feet into place on the emergency restraints under the control board, and his muscles started to burn as his body tried to react to what his eyes were seeing. The scratchy intercom sounded with Janik's voice.
"I can't get the engine restarted, Cross. It's too far gone. We've lost the tunnel drive, too."
"How long left on the batteries?" he asked.
"Coasting. Say 10 or 15 minutes. Fighting?"
Janik paused, then finished in a frustrated tone.
"A couple. Tops."
Cross nodded. It was what he expected.
"Evacuate engineering. That means you too, old man."
"Maybe I can
get the hell off my ship, Janik," he growled. "I'd like to think that you get a happily ever after. Don't screw that up for me."
The chief engineer made a sound somewhere between a chuckle and a sob.
"It's always about you, isn't it, my boy?"
"You know it, my friend. Go on, get out of here. Bridge out."
Once the departing escape pods gave him an opportunity, he hit the release for the reactor feeding the engine that had until recently been functional. The cylinder shot out through the top of the ship and jetted away. Cross sent a small wish out into the universe that the reactor would smack into an enemy and destroy it. The last attack of the Washington, D.C., he thought with a grim chuckle. He saw from the damage schematic that not much was functioning. A pale yellow haze around the ship represented functional
but mostly depleted shields. He paused between tasks and realized that what had felt to him like a half hour since he took the seat at the helm had actually been a little over a minute. The enemy ships that had been heading for Kate now curved back toward him, and the Pandora was racing up behind them at a pace he wouldn't have imagined possible. He grabbed the stick and twisted it to fire the thrusters, slowing, then stopping the ship's tumble and rolling her so that up was up. His stomach settled into its appropriate spot, and he blew out a deep, thankful breath. On-screen torpedoes and energy exploded from all the Pandora's surfaces as she blasted through an edge of the enemy formation. When the alien ships turned to engage her, the other members of Cross's squadron cut them off, allowing the Pandora to continue undelayed. There was a buzz in the intercom as Kate yelled,
"Cross, get out of there!"
The noise was overpowering, her words barely audible as the Pandora forced its way into the Washington's ancient hardwired communication system. He wished he had time to respond, to speak to her one last time.
"Evacuation status," he asked instead.
65%,
Matthews replied immediately.
"How long until they're all off?"
He jerked in alarm as the Washington dipped suddenly, and the planet filled the main display, far closer than he'd expected.
3 minutes, Captain.
"Go faster. Tell them to go faster. They have to go faster,"
he chanted, firing the ship's forward and ventral thrusters to try to break the hold, even though he knew the chance of success was minimal. It made no difference. The planet had them. The Washington tipped further forward to head at a right angle toward the edge of the atmosphere that encircled the Zhroshin home world on the battle schematic. Even as he fought with the thrusters with the hand on the stick, Cross mirrored the weapons panel to one part of his display with the other and called up the emergency protocols. He set his finger at the top, then ran it down the column of bright crimson boxes. Exterior panels, thick with armor plating, detached explosively from the hull from bow to stern. He felt the drag as the ship became even less aerodynamic, if such a thing was possible. He ran his finger up the column that appeared beside the first, all in red again. Each started blinking with a message that read, "Are you sure?" He growled a curse at Walsh's attention to detail and dragged his finger down the buttons a final time. The magazines for all the ship's guns and missile tubes were ejected in a series of tiny detonations and mighty puffs of compressed air, creating a fiery trail behind the Washington as they went.
"Increase bow shields,"
he growled, pulling on the stick to again fire the ventral thrusters on the front portion of the ship to try to shallow their dive. She failed to respond. The forward shield took on a haze in the real-time view as microscopic particles streaked across it.
"Kate, this doesn't look good," he shouted.
"Oh, no, you don't, Anderson Cross," she said,
and he heard her yell,
"Pandora, give me everything."
Her ship shot ahead and slipped underneath the Washington. He realized her plan and hit the ship-wide intercom.
"Impact imminent! Brace, brace, brace!" he called.
"Armor,"
Kate demanded, and a moment later the Pandora rammed into the underside of the Washington. His ship rebounded and skipped as it contacted the atmosphere. Then she was beyond the edge of the barrier and still flying. The Pandora bounced in the opposite direction and struck the atmosphere at an angle that would ordinarily ensure a death sentence. Her armor protected her, and he split his attention between his own piloting and the schematic showing the Pandora's course. Kate yelled,
"Come on! Come on!"
as she fought with her ship, and the Pandora's deep dive gentled into a brutal arc that had to be uncomfortable for those in it.
Speaking of uncomfortable, Cross thought, this was no joyride.
The filters were circulating as much smoke as air, and he reached down for his oxygen supply, sacrificing a second of piloting to fit the mask over his face. He turned to make sure Matthews had done the same, then demanded,
"Percentage!
90%!
Time until impact!
28 seconds!
Put the clock on the screen and get into the ready room, Matthews."
Thankfully, his tactical officer didn't argue, but took off at a run for the side room and disappeared inside. Cross entered commands at a furious pace, telling what was left of the computer when and how to fire thrusters on their descent. It was all guesswork, but it was better than nothing. He finished the final instruction and slapped his belt release. He ripped the mask off, held his breath, and dashed for the ready room. Inside, the lounging chairs along the walls had unfolded into crash couches. Matthews was already in one, and Cross fell into another. He grabbed the oxygen supply and strapped it onto his face. He raised his arms as the couch responded to his weight by extending a series of straps that secured him at shins, thighs, waist, chest, and forehead. It was disconcerting to be so tightly bound, but he knew the discomforts were just beginning. He tucked his arms back at his sides as a thick sheet rose up from each side, then sealed down the middle, activating his primal fear of confined spaces. Matthews had flicked on the main display, and the last thing Cross saw before the cocoon snapped closed over him was a verdant forest rising up to meet them. The space around him filled with a protective foam that felt like drowning. The pressure caused him to black out, and Anderson Cross knew no more. Chapter 38. The main room of the Planetary Defense Center erupted in cheers as the beam struck the trespasser's ship. The celebration continued as it spun and tumbled, then grew even louder as it plummeted into the atmosphere. Indrawn breaths filled the room when the Domeki vessel streaked into the image, as they feared it would rob them of their revenge against the trespassers. Additional jubilation resounded when it failed to save the ship from hurtling into its death spiral. Krada stood with his eyes downcast, his mind filled with gratitude. Then he said, in a quiet voice that nonetheless resonated throughout the space,
"Let us give thanks to our gods for this victory over the trespassers' ship."
The room fell silent, and Krada began to pray.
"Thank you, gods above, for fulfilling the promise laid down in the Dadas Vajro. Though we have always believed you would deliver upon your promises, we're all guilty of having harbored doubts at one time or another as we watched potential enemies fall away without being the ones we'd awaited for so long."
His voice echoed gently in the almost silent room. The only competing sounds were the hushed voices of technicians who couldn't abandon their duties.
"When the human ships violated Vassoy's creche, we wondered. You delivered us from that wonder. Through your greatness, your deep love and understanding for your children, you provided me with the knowledge that these were our enemies as foretold in the Holy Book."
Krata's wings spread, and his hands reached out.
"Some still chose not to believe. And though they acted in their best understandings of your will, their errors were confirmed, both within the lines and beyond."
His wings folded again, and his voice took on a mournful tone.
"After our defeat over the enemy's home world, additional doubt was inevitable. That loss was humbling, humiliating even. But..."
He let the word hang for several extra beats before he continued.
"But there was a lesson in it for us, and we learned that the enemy was as crafty as you'd promised they would be. With each engagement, they proved again that they were the ones. And now, in the midst of a battle over our home world, you've delivered the trespasser's ship to destruction. Just as you promised you would."
He raised his voice in triumph.
"Once again, gods and goddesses all, you've proven that you keep your promises."
Krata finished the sentence with a shout, pride in his people and their accomplishments in service of the gods and the Zhoshin future bursting forth from him. The room quieted, and no one broke the silence. Finally, Malice began to issue soft orders to redeploy ships throughout the battle above. He stepped forward to join her at the edge of the holodisplay.
"What's the situation, High Commander?"
"Our forces are currently in balance, Emperor. It's a momentary stalemate."
He nodded, her words confirming what a quick glance at the display had told him.
"And how shall we break it?"
The latest numbers indicate our reinforcements, who were furthest away, will arrive within 2/8, Emperor. When they do, they should be enough to tip the scales in our direction.
From where it hovered in the space between them, a bright bolt of destruction leapt from the floating fortress nearest the planet to incinerate a human ship. He laughed.
We might not be able to communicate with them, but the commanders of the Opal Sky know their duty.
Crada pointed at the Domeki ship positioned near the fortress.
When the time is right, dispatch as many ships as possible to capture that vessel.
He turned to the officer in charge of security for the palace and the Planetary Defense Center and asked,
What has become of the other Domeki ship? Are we safe?
Chani, who'd been in conversation with him, answered in his stead.
The Domeki vessel landed for a time near the wreckage of the trespasser ship. It then departed and is currently flying around the atmosphere of the planet. We cannot identify its purpose, but we're tracking it.
Crada could tell his seneschal had more to say, so he waited. His subordinate looked distinctly uncomfortable.
Also, Emperor, it appears that although we destroyed the trespasser ship, members of the crew are still alive. Some managed to escape before it entered the atmosphere, and we've detected heat signatures for 3 at the crash location.
Crada felt anticipation suffuse him again.
Their status? Unknown, but we've dispatched a unit to find out.
Chani cringed as if he expected a verbal lashing, but the anticipation within Crada transformed to comfort and certainty. It escaped in a heartfelt laugh. Once he'd composed himself, he said,
Don't you see, Chani? This couldn't have worked out more perfectly. First, we have the joy of downing the trespasser ship. Now, we'll have the additional pleasure of executing the survivors, where our people can watch it happen and know beyond a shadow of a doubt that the gods deliver upon their promises.
Varen's thin voice rasped from her cowl.
On the cathedral altar?
Crada slashed a hand through the air.
No, not there. We will not sully something so important to our gods with the blood of these humans.
He made a showing of considering, even though the decision had crystallized the moment he learned of the survivors. The scene had played out in his mind in an instant, as if it was really happening before him.
No, Varen, my protector. We will execute the enemies of our people in the palace, in full view of the most valued member of the castes.
He lurched into motion.
High Commander, your strategies are sound. Deliver us a victory in space. I entrust the battle to your hands.
Her spine locked even straighter, and she nodded in acknowledgement.
Chani, send messages and runners immediately to our favored members of each caste. They're to attend me in the throne room 1/8 hence.
His seneschal bobbed his head once and replied,
Yes, Emperor,
and broke away to follow his orders. Crada strode with Varen through the security checkpoints and entered the tunnels connecting the Planetary Defense Center to the palace.
You have the most important job of all, he said. Retrieve the executioner's axe and ensure the blade is ready to claim the lives of our promised, long-awaited, most hated enemies.
The woman laughed from inside her hood, a grating sound that nonetheless inspired him to join in. Together, they marched toward the pivotal moment in the history of the Zhoshin people, the final death of the trespassers. Chapter 39. The last 20 minutes had been a blur in Cross's brain, and he closed his eyes to sort them out. He remembered waking in darkness, the cocoon around him cutting off all external sensation. The control grip had slid from his hand, and he wriggled his fingers down to try to find it, pushing them against the strange, unyielding softness of the insulating foam. His claustrophobia grew. It was relieved as the cocoon split open and the insulation was discarded. He looked up and saw Kate's concerned face staring down. She removed the oxygen mask, pressed her lips to his, then pulled away and said,
"Come on, Cross. Time is of the essence."
His muscles complained mightily as he tried to stand, and his legs buckled. He caught himself on the edge of the crash couch, pushed himself back up, and paused to let the fact that he was alive wash over him.
"Fun ride, eh, boss?"
Matthew's voice sounded like he felt, bruised, battered, but still plugging away because he was too stupid to stop. Cross lifted his head and saw that the captain's skiff had landed a substantial distance from the smoking ruin that he assumed was the remains of the Washington. He tried to speak and coughed instead. Finally, he pushed out.
"Good job on launching the skiff, Matthews."
"I thought about waiting for the order, or for you to do it, but since the ground was coming up so fast, I decided it was better to just hit the button."
Cross laughed and replied,
"Well, you saved us, so I'm not going to complain about how you did it."
Kate reappeared, and the sound of engines engaging drowned out her first words. When the noise had reduced enough to communicate, she said,
"There's good news and bad news."
"I'll bite. What's the good news?"
"Pandora says that most or all of the escape pods were retrieved."
"Thank heaven,"
Cross breathed. A worry he hadn't realized he was carrying left him.
"Okay, what's the bad news?"
"It took too long to get you both free from the skiff."
Cross looked up at her and frowned.
"So?"
"So, I had to send Pandora away, so we didn't risk it falling into enemy hands."
His brain was spinning, and he couldn't connect those things. After a moment, a suspicion began to dawn in response to her words.
"What enemies?" he asked.
"Those enemies," she said,
pointing out through the missing hatch of the skiff. He looked where she directed and saw dirt and dust being disturbed by what he now realized sounded like a very large vehicle in the distance.
"Damn it," he replied, and hung his head again.
The actual capture had been surprisingly gentle. Kate told them to offer no resistance, and they followed her order. The captain's skiff, which played the role of ready room during normal ship operation, had weapons and survival gear packed under its deck. However, the timing was all wrong, and their chances of lasting on the planet for any length of time were minimal, even discounting the enemy bearing down on them. The likelihood of rescue was even smaller. He broke out of his reverie to gaze across the cabin with a lopsided grin.
"Hi, Kate. Good to see you."
She burst into laughter and raised her manacled hands to cover her face as she shook her head. Matthews, two seats away from him, also let out a bark of amusement. The bird, sitting between them in its body armor and helmet, didn't acknowledge them one way or the other. He leaned forward and felt the restraints bite into his chest.
"Kind of overkill, you guys," he remarked. "Even if I could break out of the shackles, where am I going to go?"
Again, there was no reply. Kate dropped her hands.
"Cross, in case I haven't said this before, you are something special."
"You mean that in a good way, right?"
he asked. He was sure her response would have been yes, but suddenly the vehicle stopped, and they were quickly ushered from it. As they stepped out into the sunlight, he caught a whirl of people, aliens of every size and color, crowded around the path between the vehicle and a set of ornamental stairs. Guards flowed through the doors to the top of the staircase and created a path by pushing the crowds to each side. They were marched ahead and subjected to shouts, whistles, and other cacophonic emanations from the surrounding beings. Once the doors slammed shut behind them, the silence of the high-ceilinged hallway descended upon them like a shroud. Matthews coughed derisively.
"Apparently a perp walk is a perp walk, no matter your species," he said.
Cross frowned, then caught the reference. They were, indeed, prisoners on display. Well, he'd just have to see how much entertainment he could provide the bastards. His brain jumped to an image of the commander of the Ruby Rain, and he hoped he'd get a chance. Just one chance to punch the vexing wench square in the mouth, the beak, whatever. The guards who escorted them in were replaced by another set, the latter clad in ornamental armor and colors matching the decorative elements in the long hallway. They held up small devices and slipped them into the right ears of each human, nestling the earpieces snugly into place.
"This way,"
they said in their language, and the earpiece crackled with a translation. They advanced slowly, as if giving the prisoners time to contemplate their fate, or to admire the mural that ran along the corridor walls. The images were strange, but it was possible to make out the story nonetheless, when one considered where they were.
"All glory to the kings,"
Kate said in an undertone, and Cross nodded.
"Looks like something out of ancient Rome, or a tomb of a pharaoh," he replied. She brightened for a second.
"I wonder if they see their rulers as divine, the way our historical cultures did. It would support the idea that somehow all life in the universe came from the same source, the carvings under the mountain."
Cross laughed and shook his head in admiration of the passion she brought to everything. She trailed off, uncertainly, and stared at him while they plodded forward.
"What?"
she demanded.
"I love you, Kate. And whether it's measured in minutes, hours, or years, I want to spend the rest of my life with you."
She broke into a wry grin and said,
"Oh, sure. Now you say that, when we're probably walking to our deaths."
He shrugged.
"Doesn't change the truth of it."
She nodded, a serious expression taking over her face.
"It does not. I love you as well. And I hope our time together will be measured in years rather than days."
"Or minutes,"
Matthews interjected as they came to the end of the corridor and turned toward the gigantic doors that yawned open before them.
"Holy hell,"
Cross breathed. Ahead lay the largest, most ornamental space he'd ever encountered. The floor looked to be pure sapphire blocks in a line up to the base of an enormous set of stairs. To either side of the azure path gathered aliens dressed in sumptuous robes, talking amongst themselves. The conversations fell silent as the humans were ushered in. As they cleared the doorway, he could see the throne at the very top of the golden staircase, and the being seated atop it. It was draped in garments finer than any around them, and a thin circlet of some unknown metal gleamed in changing hues on its brow. Its wings unfurled as it spotted them, then folded back into place. At its left was another alien, clad in a uniform modeled after the finery of its superior. At its right, a figure wrapped in a black robe hid under a dark hood, its features invisible. The guards prodded him forward, and he stumbled ahead. Kate and Matthews did the same. And Cross realized the three of them must have been standing in place like primitives treated to their first sight of technology. He caught his balance and turned the stumble into a purposeful stride. As he approached the bottom step, a brace of guards stepped in to block his path. He looked up, and the being on the throne stood to address.
"Trespasser! Defiler! Enemy of the Joshin people! Finally, you've come to receive the reward for your transgressions."
The being paced as it spoke.
"The gods have brought us to this day, to this moment. The ancestors of the Joshin people will be delivered onto paradise when your blood and that of your entire species stains the stones. Your fleet is falling into defeat above, and your lives are forfeit here below. So may it be."
Cross startled as the crowd around him chanted,
"So may it be. Varen, the royal executioner, shall attend to your sacrifice and deliver you to the afterlife."
The ebon-robed figure began to descend. From an unnoticed corner, an attendant emerged, holding the largest axe he'd ever seen. Its haft was easily 2 meters long, and the metal blade shone in the uneven lighting, catching the flickering illumination from the chandeliers above and reflecting them in specular shimmers around the room. Cross gave Kate a look of apology, then shouted,
"May I be allowed to speak?"
The earpiece rendered a translation that emerged from hidden speakers somewhere in the space. Meanwhile, the gallery erupted with the bird's version of laughter. The executioner paused and looked over its shoulder at the figure atop the dais. The alien spread his arms wide in what was clearly intended as a patronizing gesture.
As you've reached the final moments of your existence, I suppose it's appropriate to allow you a moment to grovel.
His audience loved it, and the alien's laughter continued. Cross's eyebrows narrowed and his lips twisted into a sneer. He raised his cuffed hands and said,
"It's really easy to act brave up there, bird face. How about we settle this one-on-one? I created the situation that destroyed your relic. Kill me and let my people go."
He locked his eyes on the figure above to avoid Kate's gaze. The alien made a performance of considering Cross's words, tapping his chin with a long claw, then said,
"Our gods don't require the sacrifice of a single human, despite the pleasure I'd take in ending you myself. They demand the blood of all humans. I reject your proposal."
Something, a half-recalled snippet of a conversation, banged its way to the front of his mind.
"Okay, then. I've heard repeatedly stories of one of your commanders who offered ritual battle for possession of the worlds she attacked. She said this approach was sacred to your culture. You've named us as your enemy from prophecy and declared that your gods demand our lives. Fine. By your own rules, I challenge you to personal combat for the prize of humanity."
Kate groaned at his side. The gallery was quiet, stunned, he imagined, before erupting into mocking laughter again. The figure sat on the throne and leaned over to confer with the official beside him. They appeared to argue, and the being gave a decisive nod and gestured for the alien who had yet to speak to step forward.
"Emperor and Hierarch Krodotok finds this request in keeping with the history of the Zhoshin culture and the word of the gods. Many times in the past, our slave races joined us in this manner, with a chosen representative battling on behalf of the entire species. We ask the senior of the non-combatant humans to agree to stand by the results of this battle. If your champion loses, you swear to submit to the will of the Zhoshin people, be it slavery or extinction."
Kate turned to face the throne.
"I am Commander Kathleen Margaret Flynn. I promise that this shall be so."
One of her hands was cupped in the other, and from his angle he saw that her fingers were crossed. He almost laughed at the gesture, despite knowing she'd never keep a commitment given under duress, even had she been empowered to speak for humanity. Nor had he wanted her to. If he won, maybe something good would happen. If he lost, they were no worse off, and every second he bought them was one more second for Okoye or someone else in orbit to get them out of this mess. The being at the top, who was undoubtedly the one the flunky had named Emperor Krodotok, stood and strode to the lip of the platform.
"Our religion and historical precedent allow one more thing, human. They permit me to select a champion to represent me. I choose my royal protector, Varen."
The dark being that had lingered on the stairs during the interchange gave a small bow to the Emperor, then continued its descent.
"You have a single 8 to prepare, humans. Then battle will commence."
The guards pushed the three off to the side and rearranged the audience. Soon he saw the clear outlines of an octagon, set with shimmering stones at each point. Their escorts withdrew to a respectful distance after removing their manacles. Apparently, playing upon the bird's religious beliefs had earned them a modicum of respect.
"You're an idiot, Cross,"
Kate said with a frown on her face.
"You had a better idea?"
"Well, actually,"
she began before Matthews interrupted,
"I like how you just assumed you're so important you can make decisions for all of humanity, Captain. Kind of confirms what I've always thought about your view of yourself."
Cross looked at him, his jaw falling open, and the three of them broke into dark laughter again.
"Honestly," Kate said, "I rarely know whether I want to kiss you or kill you, Anderson Cross."
"It appears that someone else has dibs on the latter,"
he he replied with a pointed glance toward the alien figure engaged in a series of ritual stretches on the other side of the arena. Kate looked distracted and failed to respond. He frowned at her, and she turned and scratched her neck below her left ear. He realized she was wearing a second earpiece, different than the one they'd